On the final mission to Hubble, 7 astronauts embarked on an expedition to save it. And an IMAX 3D camera was on board to capture it.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Nell Bowes. On this week's podcast, we look at the science of laughter.
Did you hear about the ice cream man? He was found dead in his ice cream van, covered in chocolate sauce, hundreds and thousands. The police said that he had topped himself.
Plus, we reveal the world's funniest joke. It may even be the one Monty Python discovered.
We had translators working in joke-proof conditions to try and produce a German version of the joke. They worked on one word each for greater safety. One of them saw two words of the joke and spent several weeks in hospital.
We gaze into space as Hubble and Leonardo DiCaprio take us through the Orion Nebula.
The whole world waited for Hubble to open its enormous eye.
And we gaze into the future and look at how today's research could influence tomorrow's technologies.
Maybe as part of mobile phones that everybody carries around microphones with them, we do automatically every day now. So we could crowdsource this sound information.
If any illegal genetic modifications were found, the police could look at the video of the bee doing a waggle dance.
This is Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk. Welcome. In the studio today, our guest is psychologist Professor Richard Wiseman from the University of Hertfordshire. He's an expert in the quirkier areas of the discipline, including deception, humour, luck, and the paranormal. And it's quite a moment for the podcast. Richard, I believe you're our first guest with their own iPhone app.
That's very exciting.
Oh, it's extremely exciting. We've all been downloading and playing it. I think Andy's going to try and claim it back on expenses, but it's only 59p for those who are interested. Tell us how it works. What's it based on?
Oh, well, this is a mind-reading app. It's called Telepath, and I created it with Sarah Anglis. And it's basically allows you to read the minds of anyone you meet. You show them four numbers. You ask them to think of a number. You put the iPhone face down. You say, what number have you chosen? They say whatever it is, number 3, for example. You say, turn over the iPhone. They turn it over. You don't. And lo and behold, number 3 on the screen. And you can be a huge hit at any party. It's guaranteed to make you centre of attention.
And how does it actually work?
I have no idea. Even though I helped create it, I have no idea. It's like magic to me. It's something to do with the power of thought influencing electronics. That's all I know.
Anyway, that's not why you're here. We're going to discuss the science of laughter.
Absolutely, yes.
Which I believe you're giving a talk on at the Royal Institute on 31st of March.
31st of March, I'll be down there talking about psychology of humour, why we laugh, what we laugh at, why we don't find things funny, whether men and women have different senses of humour. So basically covering all the different bases on humour.
All the different bases. Well, producer Andy, who's someone not normally known for his humour, took to the streets of London to find out what makes people laugh.
Two fish in a tank. One turns to the other and says, do you know how to drive this?
No, I don't.
Okay. Did you not understand that?
What's the point of it?
Okay, well, that didn't work. Was it my delivery?
Your delivery was obviously perfect, but I'm not very good at jokes.
Did you hear about the man who drowned in a bowl of muesli? He was pulled under by a strong current.
Ha, 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 ha.
Two owls are playing in the final of the Owl Pool Championship. It comes down to the last frame. One of the owls is just about to play his shot when his wing accidentally touches a ball. That's two hits, says the other owl. Two hits to who, says the first.
Yes. Well, it's very good, very amusing, yes.
Yep. Okay, what about the delivery? Is that all right?
Yeah, it did well. Yes, absolutely. Yes, I knew the punchline before you got to it, so a bit predictable, but very good.
I said to the gym instructor, can you teach me to do the splits? He said, how flexible are you? I said, I can't make Tuesdays.
Very good.
Can you think of any?
No, I can never remember the end, the vital bit.
I used to have a really good joke, I was told, but it's gone right out of my head. I'm sorry, I can't think of it.
There's a farmer wakes up one morning and he goes and checks his herd of cows and he realises that they're just frozen solid. And he really worried about this and he's like going up to them, knocking on them, he just can't figure it out. So he gets a vet and the vet comes along and says the same thing. I don't know what that's all about, they're all totally solid. But the vet does say, yeah, I do know somebody that might be able to help. And he's like, well, who's that then? He went, Thor a herd. Hey, that's one of my little favourites.
Okay, well, that's good. Yeah. I'll give you mine. Two Ariels met on a roof, fell in love and got married. The ceremony was rubbish, but the reception was brilliant.
Oh, man. A couple of groaners, really, aren't they?
Producer Andy there, failing to bring sunshine into the lives of Londoners. So, why do we laugh?
Well, what's interesting about laughter is we don't really know why we laugh. It is something of a mystery. There is some sense in which it's a social signal. We don't tend to laugh out loud on our own. So if we're watching a funny film and you're the only person in the room, you might laugh a little bit, but you're not going to be sitting there going, ho, 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 ho. I mean, you might, but you'd be a deeply strange person if that happened. You put even one other person in the room, and without thinking about it, suddenly people start to laugh out loud when something funny happens. And so for some reason, from the evolutionary point of view, laughter is a social signal. And one theory is that it is really a way of saying to people, I've seen something surprising but non-threatening. So you could imagine that if you see a tiger in the bushes, you have to let the rest of the group know there's a tiger over there and there'd be one particular outburst for that. If you see something that surprises you and then you realise actually it's there's nothing threatening about it, it's just a tree or something, and I thought it was a tiger, then that's got to be a different signal. And one theory is that's what the laugh is. It's surprising us, but it's non-threatening. And that's one idea about the evolution of laughter.
Because I remember doing an undergrad 8 years ago, somebody doing a thesis on laughter, and there being absolutely nothing in the literature about it at all. Where's research on laughter got to now?
Well, there's a little bit more out there. I mean, Robert Provine over in America has carried out quite a lot of research into it. But still, we don't understand that much about it. It's obviously a social psychological issue. It touches on many different aspects of our lives. So one of the pieces of research that Robert did was to look at personal ads and whether or not a good sense of humour is a desirable thing. And lo and behold, men and women both ask for that in their partners. But they mean very different things by that. When a man says, I find a woman attractive if she's got a good sense of humour, what he means is, I'd like someone around me who laughs at my jokes. What a woman means is that I like a guy who makes me laugh.
Right.
So there is a complexity to it because, people are using the same terms in very different ways. And I think that's what I find fascinating about humour and laughter. It's inherently social, but obviously with a deep kind of underpinning in terms of the neurology of it.
And it's jokes rather than, as you say, a sort of wider application of humour or...
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, joke's just one particular part of humour. And in fact, if you carry out any of those diary studies where you ask people, what made you laugh today and so on, yes, guys tell jokes to one another. Women don't. Women tell funny stories about, whatever happened to them or their friend or whatever. So there are many ways of making people laugh, and joke telling is really just a small part of the pie. And in terms of cross-cultural differences, most of the research, including ours, has shown that for the most part, we laugh at the same types of things. So we laugh at people in power being taken down a peg or two. We laugh at somebody else falling over on the banana skin. We don't laugh when it's us falling over on the banana skin. We laugh at things that surprise us. We laugh, if you put it in Freudian terms, at things which deal with our everyday anxieties. It's why so many jokes about, man goes to the doctor and so on. We laugh at illness. We laugh at people in unhappy relationships and so on. So those are universal factors. Yes, the way in which they manifest themselves in any one particular culture at any one particular time will indeed be,
culture-specific, who happens to be in power at that time.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Or the issues that particular group finds funny. Fundamentally, we're laughing at the same things.
What other things affect humour? Is there a best time of the day to tell a joke?
Well, they say that humour is all about timing, and that's one of the things we could look at scientifically. We had 1.5 million people take part in the experiment, and we logged the day of the month that they were rating the jokes, and in fact the precise time of day for them, given their particular time zone. So when we collapsed all of those ratings, we could see a very nice curve over the course of the month, with people finding things funnier towards the middle of the month compared to the ends. It was quite a strong effect.
Really?
Absolutely.
How extraordinary.
So there's something about the middle of months versus the beginning and ends of them. And also across the course of the day, you could see that people didn't find things particularly funny first thing in the morning, but then they'd wake up around about sort of lunchtime, you know, in terms of humour.
So actually, did you correct for time zone when you were doing
That's right. We asked people which country they were from, which then allowed us to see which countries found the jokes funniest. It turns out that it was actually the Germans, which
really
caused international headlines.
I can see all the journalists going, oh, brilliant.
Absolutely, absolutely. But the Germans loved it because they said, there we are. We told you we've got a great sense of humour, and now it's been proved scientifically. The people who hated that finding was the Canadians because they came bottom. And so they actually questions asked in the Canadian Parliament about the Laugh Lab
finding. Are we
finding
the least funny nation?
Precisely. And so what they did was to come back online and say, look, your jokes are so bad that what kind of fools would find these funny? So that's how we corrected for time zone. And what you could see is that it was actually 3 minutes past six in the evening that things were maximally funny. So if you do want to be a stand-up comic, then getting yourself on stage, middle
early
of the
slot.
Month, at 3 minutes past six.
How come? Did you have any theories on the mechanism? Why?
No, I think that was probably just a pretty much a cherry-picked time out of the graph. It has to peak somewhere. And unlike the time of the month, that wasn't a nice curve. That was burbling all over the place. But it did peak at 3 minutes past six.
So did you have theories for the beginning, for the middle of the month?
I don't have any theories for that. People could write in.
Thank you very much, Richard. You can check out his website or even download his iPhone app on laughlab.co.uk. As I said, Richard Wiseman will be doing a talk at the RI on the 31st of March. And Richard will come back to you at the end of the programme where we'll reveal the world's funniest joke.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
It's about 9 trillion miles away and 24 light years across. But you can now fly through it in less than an hour. An amazing recreation of the Orion Nebula is the star of a new IMAX film. Hubble 3D is narrated by Leonardo DiCaprio. Its European premiere was held at London Science Museum.
'm David Brower, Regional Manager of Europe, Middle East, and Africa for IMAX Corporation. We're talking, you know, several hundred pounds of camera to actually maneuver and manipulate, and also the reel that you film with the camera is relatively short. I think it's under 6 minutes long. It's 3 to 6 minutes, so you can't really screw up the process. I mean, just like the astronauts are training not to screw something up when they're fixing Hubble, when they're using the film, there's only a fixed amount of film they were able to bring up. You know, they need to be able to not screw that up. And as you can see in the film, there's a lot of the footage that they filmed that turned out pretty well.
Well, I just finished shooting an IMAX scene, and so I'm done with that, so I want to get a little exercise in before I shoot my next scene. So it's a little stress relief here on the mid-deck.
Most of Hubble's instruments were designed for apparent space, but not the advanced camera for surveys. When its power supply failed, the only hope was to remove and replace fragile circuit boards inside the camera. It's like performing brain surgery with oven mitts.
For us to work on rendering the actual images that Hubble caught, looking out at, you know, millions and tens of millions of miles out into the universe, we were able to take those images actually and transform them into a way of looking through the universe in actual reality, which I'm not quite sure has ever really been done in that way before.
The Hubble Space Telescope allows us to go to places so far away that it's inconceivable that humans will ever go there.
The trickiest thing was probably the rendering process. It took 480 processors, believe it or not, 24 hours a day for 5 weeks just to do the Orion Nebula fly-through sequence, which is just absolutely spectacular. So yeah, it's a little complicated.
With the sea and clouds of Earth reflecting on its door, the Great Silver Bird was released to soar in orbit 320 miles above us.
Hubble 3D is being shown at London Science Museum. For more info, go to imax.com/Hubble. A fifth-dimensional camera, sustainable energy animals, phantom recorders and fabulous fabbers. They're all part of a new science exhibition at the Royal College of Art in London called Impact. By looking at some of the latest research, designers have predicted what that technology may help create in the future. I dispatched producer Andy to take a peek into tomorrow.
Hello, I'm Tony Dunn. I'm the head of the Design Interactions Department at the Royal College of Art. Basically, the project aims to connect 16 designers and design groups with 16 research projects going on around the UK. And it's very important that it's not really about simply just communicating what the scientists are doing or trying to predict the future, but more trying to look at a whole range of different possibilities and impacts the research might have on society. So some of them are a little bit obscure, some of them are dark, and others kind of celebrate the more positive aspects.
As you walk through the exhibition, there's a whole world of different shapes and sounds. Behind me is something that looks like it's just fallen from space on parachute, going past a tiny little circus tent village on a table. There's a black and white video of a man falling down some stairs backwards, and still pictures of Wembley Stadium as far as I can tell.
I'm Professor Mark Plumley at Queen Mary University of London. Here we've got a designer's idea of what the world might be like if there were machines that could listen and understand and separate the sounds around us, give us a sort of super hearing. And not just from what specific applications we could think of as scientists and engineers, but how it would change the way that people feel about the world of sound around them. So here's an example for public health. Suppose people didn't want to go out into areas of the city where there were lots of colds around. Could you get a map where the city would listen to the coughs and sneezes that were around, and you could look at them on a Google map or something like that and say, okay, there are a lot of coughs and sneezes there, so I'm not going to go there. Instead, I'm going to go walking in this park where there are no other people with coughs and sneezes, so I won't catch anything. Maybe as part of mobile phones that everybody carries around microphones with them, we do automatically every day now, and so we could crowdsource this sound information, but at the same time we'd have to be very careful about how that were used. So people maybe would agree that certain types of sounds, general sounds from the world around us, would be fed into a mapping system to help people know where that would be. But the sort of speech that we would give when we're talking to each other, we wouldn't want that to be distributed to everywhere else.
Well, I'm standing in front of a rather strange contraption, something you might perhaps see at a kind of a school art fair. Almost a boat-like shape with a inverted satellite dish, a bit of wood, lots of wires, a couple of fluorescent tubes on, an umbilical cord that then goes to a wooden platform with some cocktail sticks on. All very strange and very elaborate, but this is the future of energy production, apparently. This is an energy animal which will combine wave, wind and solar energy in a single energy converter. There's even some ping pong balls involved.
I'm Thomas Thwaites, a designer, and I was working with the UCL Crime and Security Science Doctoral Training Centre. Techniques of genetically modifying plants and bacteria are kind of in reach of the amateur and perhaps the criminal as well. So I was imagining that you might get people, you know, growing their own sort of anti-aging drug in their back garden, or criminals genetically modifying plants, you know, which look innocent, to kind of produce, you know, some kind of valuable substance. So I was imagining that the police would need to keep track of this, and they would use bees to do so. So the bees would go out, kind of do their, you know, collecting of pollen, you know, flying over the back fence of people's gardens, and then they'd come back, and this pollen would be captured in a pollen trap. The waggle dance that the bees do would be videoed, and then later the pollen would be analysed, and if any illegal genetic modifications were found, the police could look at the video of the bee doing a waggle dance, and then decode the dance to work out where the bee had been, you know, the direction and distance from the hive to the source of the pollen, and then they could obtain a warrant and go and you know, do a bit of further sampling to see what was going on.
For more information, go to impactexhibition.org.uk. You'll find that link on our Facebook pages. We've handily called ourselves the Guardian Science Weekly Podcast. You can chat with other listeners and also post comments on the wall there. Plus, as a special free once-in-a-lifetime offer, we'll message you every Monday to remind you when a new podcast is uploaded.
Science Weekly.
Back in the day, Monty Python wrote a sketch about the world's funniest rib tickler.
This man is Ernest Scribbler, manufacturer of jokes. In a few moments, he will think of the funniest joke in the world, and as a result, he will die laughing. It was obvious the joke was lethal. No one could read it and live.
Well, we've never found out what that joke on the piece of paper was, but we may well have it right here in the studio. I'm wearing special gloves right now. For obvious reasons, this must carry a health warning. If you don't want to die of laughing, turn off now. So, Richard, how did you come up with the funniest joke?
Well, that was a very straightforward piece of maths. We asked people to rate each of the jokes on a 5-point scale from not very funny to very funny. And then we found the joke that had the highest ratings and therefore, according to us, the funniest joke in the world.
You're sort of, when you think of the world's funniest joke, you want someone to come up with something that you've never heard of before that is...
I think part of the problem is that I was a fan of the small jokes, the quick jokes, you know, what you call a monkey in a minefield, a baboom. I like that joke.
Brown and sticky.
Exactly. 315 times we had that joke.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Emma, who was doing the vetting, said, we just sort of shout through, another brown and sticky come in. So I like those quick, you know, the woman who walks into a bar and asks for a double entendre, barman gives her one. All those kind of quick jokes I like. The winning joke, you know, is quite long. I have to tell every time I give the talk. It goes on for ages. It's living hell because you know there's no funny punchline. So the audience
and
are looking at it.
Yeah. Talk about a build-up.
Exactly. World's funniest joke. Here it is. You know, it takes a few minutes to tell. Everyone's, oh, my goodness. And then they experience what we experienced all those years ago when we realised it was a terrible joke but had won.
Well, now I think we've made everyone wait long enough. In second place is...
Two hunters are out in the woods when one of them collapses. He doesn't seem to be breathing and his eyes are glazed. The other guy whips out his phone and calls the emergency services. He gasps, my friend is dead, what can I do? The operator says, calm down, I can help. First, let's make sure he's dead. There's a silence, then a shot is heard. Back on the phone, the guy says, okay, now what?
And then the officially, scientifically, world leader in all things funny. Don't worry about the build-up. Brace yourself.
Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson were going camping. They pitched their tent under the stars and went to sleep. Sometime in the middle of the night, Holmes woke Watson up and said, Watson, look up at the stars and tell me what you see. Watson replied, I see millions and millions of stars. Holmes said, and what do you deduce from that? Watson replied, well, if there are millions of stars, and even if a few of those have planets, it's quite likely there are some planets like Earth out there. And if there are a few planets like Earth out there, there might also be life. And Holmes said, Watson, you idiot, it means that somebody stole our tent.
So there it is, the world's funniest joke, officially. Richard, will you please do that?
Well, two things. First of all, I'd like to apologise to everyone for inflicting that joke on them. It's not a terrible joke, actually. It's just fairly bad. But second, I think what we did, because we took an average across all of these jokes, we found the world's blandest joke. I mean, we found the joke that appeals to the same level to most people. Most people go, yeah, it's all right, but I know a funnier one. So within any subgroup, whether it's men or women or young or old, there'll be another joke which they find much funnier. But when you take the average, you know, it's like taking the average of everyone's favourite colour. You know, you're probably going to end up with beige. Exactly. We've found the colour beige.
The beige equivalent in the joke world.
And I'm proud of that. Proud of that.
It's a noble calling. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, at Science Weekly, we'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And to be alerted to all Guardian Science content, follow at Guardian Science. Our thanks to Professor Richard Wiseman. Check him out at richardwiseman.com and laughlab.co.uk. Next week, quantum theorist Vlatko Vedral will be in the studio with us. He's also in a band, and therefore we are obliged to call him a rock star physicist. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. While you're there, click the link to subscribe for free so every podcast gets automatically delivered to your MP3 device. It takes all the hard work out of listening. You could even leave your favourite joke on there. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Nell Bowes. Thanks for listening. Okay, a man walks into a bar. Ouch. Is that bad? That's really bad. What's brown and sticky? We've done that one. Another really bad potato joke about Des Lynam. No, it's not gonna. It's all based around the pun of a commentator. It's terrible.